This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to Live and Learn. I'm Chua Eun Teik. My guest today is Dr. Neil Kaur, Chief Operating Officer of Think City and author of The Towns of Malaya, an illustrated urban history of the peninsula up to 1957, which he co-wrote with Mariana Issa and Mangajit Kaur. Neil, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
So, can I start with asking you, why did you think this book was needed?
That is a very interesting question, whether or not any book is needed at all. I think it's a purely human pursuit to do something which may not be necessarily needed at a particular point in time, but to do it with tenacity and love is what makes us human. So in a roundabout way, I think that if there is one seminal contribution this book will make, it is to put together in the using the medium of visual history, as captured through photography, our collective urban history. So that could be one singular contribution at this point in time.
Yeah, there are some amazing pictures that you've featured in this book, and the reason why you chose this time frame, 150 years in the lead up to 1957, was because of the development of photography. How did you find all these pictures?
Well, that itself is quite an interesting question. Basically, what happened was that I was working in the Star newspaper at that time, and I was going through some research assignments at the National Archives. And I stumbled upon the collection of the Malayan Information Agency. The Malayan Information Agency, of course, later on became RTM. And essentially, the National Archives had inherited all these glass negatives of all these photographs. And they were originally used to promote Malaya as a market for investment, for investors in London and in other places.
As far back as the 19th century?
Yes, because you must remember that a lot of the agency houses like Boustead and Sime Darby in those ancient days, they were all companies floated in London. And so the investors in London wanted to know where their money was going and for what purpose. So these glass negatives would then usually be projected using a lantern to show how wonderful this place called Malaya was and how good it was to invest your money here.
Mm. Yeah. So it's a very glossy, sanitized version of what Malaya was back then. Would that be a fair characterization?
Yes and no. I think that, of course, whereas photography evolved as an art form, you must sort of understand that in its beginnings, the photographer, the role of the photographer was somewhat like an artist. So they had to frame things properly because they only had one basic shot at capturing a particular sense of reality. So this art form of presenting a picture of a particular place to suit particular tastes goes back to the earliest trade paintings in that you can find in the Penang Museum and other places. So trade paintings played a similar role, which to interest investors, particularly if you're investing in the East India Company, you will want to know what sort of place Penang was, for example. So you had all the William Daniels and Captain Robert Smith trade paintings. And these were actually done on lithograph. So in the 20th century, as photography developed and became more and more commonplace, what happened was that you could then take more accurate photographs to show the topography of the country. And of course, as it became more affordable for the common person to have the use of the photograph, you will notice that photographs from the 1950s in the book was actually more democratic, with more scenes of social life and everything else that's captured by the average man on the street. And of course, today, we cannot live without posting a photograph on Facebook. So that trend continues.
Yeah. Why a coffee table book format?
Well, firstly, I like beautiful things. And essentially, I have learned a very important lesson. If you were to write a long dissertation, nobody is going to actually read it. Huh? And I felt that it would be more interesting to use visual history as a kind of documentary heritage to get the message across. And the message is that our towns and cities and the entire urbanization process had many beginnings, false starts, and what you see today is actually the result of a lot of sacrifice and a lot of labor and a lot of work done by earlier generations. And that is why the book not only features these nice glossy photographs as you have described, but they are also augmented by personal stories from personalities who have lived in those towns from that era. So that, I hope, makes not only a handsome book, but an interesting read.
It was the book is organized into four parts, royal towns, port towns, mining towns, and then this other categories of miscellaneous towns. Mm. Is there a common thread among all these towns in the story that you want to tell?
I have this very bad habit of, finding, I think I must have been quite a lonely child. Huh? So the whole idea is that you look at your natural environment and then you try to categorize things. And that was the task ahead of me, because I'd found all these wonderful photographs. But then what do you do with them? Do you present them as a singular story of urbanization? I thought that would be rather flat. So instead of doing that, I thought I would focus on the story of urbanization itself, beginning from centers or urban centers before the coming of colonialism. And the only way that you could do this is actually to focus on the royal towns. So the royal towns were actually there before the arrival of the colonial immigrant economy. Then port towns were actually outlets for the influence of the colonial immigrant economy, with its antecedent energies that spilled into the peninsula. And of course, the whole economy was an extractive one. So you were trying to bring tin and rubber and oil palm out, palm oil out into the export market. And therefore, you have the mining towns, the plantation towns, and the transport towns. The last category of the miscellaneous towns, I must admit, that was the contribution of my co-authors, Mariana and Manjit, and who have done a wonderful job in helping me fact-check and providing very contrasting views. And I think they felt that there were all these other towns that Neil's categorization sort of failed to capture, and I thank them. And so you see that there are hill stations, which are also a kind of a township on its own. You also find transport hubs, and I think as the economy became more and more sophisticated and the political unity became more and more apparent after the Second World War, then you have the beginnings of what I call a nation state.
So is this concept of township already pre-existing even before the arrival of a colonial master?
Oh yes, I think when we think about townships, we're thinking about urbanization, and what we mean by urbanization essentially is economic density. It's you and me deciding that we are going to set up a place of trade, or you and me deciding that we are going to worship a particular deity, and then we get lots of people to rally around those causes, and then we find that there's so many of these people, we have got to deal with all the externalities of living closely together, and that means we have got to have a police force, we've got to have sanitation systems, but of course at the same time there's got to be entertainment. There's got to be a whole range of amenities and services around this nucleus that we have called a town. Yeah. So in the case of the royal towns, to answer your question in a roundabout way, these were actually concentrations both of economic power and political power. So Kuala Kangsar, for example, is the royal town, the royal capital of Perak today. But you must understand that in the case of Perak, the epicenter of power is spread in the coastal area, in the middle area, and in the Ulu. So that's because it's based on one singular river. In Selangor, it's completely different again because each royal the royal house is actually almost a kind of paramount ruler over chieftains in different kinds of rivers in parallel to each other. So depending on the evolution of the royal town, you get a different kind of urban settlement pattern.
I'm speaking today to Neil Kaur about the book Towns of Malaya. We'll talk more after a short break. BFM 89.9. You're listening to Live and Learn. I'm Chua Intik. My guest today is Neil Kaur, one among three authors of the book Towns of Malaya, an illustrated urban history of the peninsula up to 1957. Neil, do we have to thank the British for sanitation or things like local government at all, or were these already organized in the royal towns?
I think that if you want to apportion credit, you should always credit the locals. And if you want to apportion blame, you can always blame the British. That is the easiest way to get around this minefield. And the reality is that I think it took everyone's efforts to make it work. So, of course, when the colonial immigrant economy started to be based out of the Straits settlements, and this I refer to Penang, Malacca, Singapore, and to a large extent the Dindings, which is now Lumut area, they were all part of the Straits settlements. These were actually colonial port towns. And the way they were organized was, particularly the case of Singapore, was to facilitate trade. So you will notice that the main economic activity is around the port. So in Penang, for example, Welkie or Swettenham Pier would be where a lot of trade would be concentrated. And so you notice that all around the water's edge, you have what's called go-downs or warehouses. Then the political power would be residing within the fort, in this case of Penang, Fort Cornwallis. So this pattern was repeated everywhere. In the case of the Malay states, the British then had to, in a sense, aggregate and coalesce and align the way they would run a town with what was already in existence. So in the case of the royal towns, they, by and large, particularly in the east coast of the peninsula, like in Kota Baru and Kuala Terengganu, they left things to the locals to decide. And in the case of the federated Malay states of Perak, Pahang, Negeri Sembilan and Selangor, basically what the British did was to introduce what are called sanitary boards. And as what their name represents, sanitary boards are essentially built up or created to manage waste, and all the externalities of urbanization. So you can say that in the case of the federated Malay states and the Straits settlements, the British gave us left to us a legacy of laws that regulate how we build, how we live together, and how we manage traffic and pedestrians and people. And in the case of the unfederated Malay states, particularly in Johor Bahru, you have a very interesting hybrid system of urban management that is very much inspired by locals who modernize on their own terms.
What does that mean, modernize on your own terms? Did they evolve as the needs arise?
Well, of course, in the case of Johor Bahru, originally known as Iskandar Puteri, when the Temenggong and Maharaja Abu Bakar moved from Telok Blangah in Singapore to establish a new modern capital city in the Johor mainland, he modernized the state on local terms. And what I mean by this is that the style may be to follow the best of Western tradition at that time, but the surveyors, the architects, and the district officers were all actually locals. And this meant that they actually would then take on what they felt were important lessons from the West in terms of urban planning. But the flavor was very much a local one. So I suppose a parallel in terms of something that we can more easily understand would be what the Straits Chinese, the Peranakan Chinese, did when issues of modernity arose. So they learned English, sent their children to English school, but when they went home, they were very much celebrating the rituals of following the Chinese calendar. So you can say that they have modernized, quote-unquote, on their own terms.
And was there any semblance of a democracy back then in terms of representation on how the people wanted their communities to be organized? Who wielded power in local planning?
Okay, you have got to think about democracy within the continuum of the limitations of the era. Places like Georgetown, which was started in 1786, obviously had a longer history of what I call civic participation. So the genesis of the municipal council or local government in Penang, or Georgetown in this case, was the Committee of Assessors, which was set up in 1805. This is the group of people who would sit down and decide how much assessment you pay. And up to today, we still have to pay assessment or cukai pintu. And basically, this were, in the early days, these were the leading property owners of the day. And they would come together and work together, including with the colonial government, to collect assessment rates, which they would then use to build toilets and build drains and et cetera, all right? In 1852-53, modernization and local representation or local level elections were taking root in England. And so by 1857, Penang actually had elected members to the municipal council, of which you have a right to vote if you actually own property, right? And this was the same franchise that you had in the United Kingdom. And of course, only men can vote and only men can be elected. And if I'm not mistaken, the first man who was elected with the highest number of votes in 1857 was Koh Siang Tat, who was the descendant of Kapitan China Koh Le Huan, the first Kapitan China of Penang. And of course, this was, in a sense, very limited, because although they were elected, they could be overruled by the governor in council. And then we did not have any more elections until 1951 in Penang, where the first local elections was held. And then, of course, by 1952, it was in Kuala Lumpur.
And what stopped after 1857? Why wasn't there another election?
Well, it was not really very popular, and not many people wanted to participate, because it was quite an acrimonious relationship between the elected representatives and the governor in council, who could simply overrule things. So they felt it was like a not very progressive. But having said that, it sort of worked for a while, and up to about 1890s, then it sort of petered out. And what happened was that the unelected representatives would be appointed by the governor in council, very much like what you have today. Except that it's the chief ministers or the Menteri Besar who appoint local councillors. Yeah. So in 1964, if I'm not mistaken, that was when local elections were abolished in the country.
So if I understand this correctly, the unfederated Malay states were able to more or less develop on their own terms, mm-hmm. whereas the federated Malay states, the British were more hands-on in terms of in guiding their development and shaping the townships. And please correct me if I'm wrong, mm-hmm. were these management that came from the British welcome, or were there any resentment?
Okay, so there are two questions there. So the first one is whether or not in the unfederated Malay states, local people and local rulers had more of a say in how cities evolve. And I think the answer is definitely yes. And that is why you notice that the royal towns are also the main towns of those unfederated Malay states. So Kuala Terengganu is still sort of the main city of the state of Terengganu. Similarly, Kota Baru and Johor Bahru, they are royal towns as well as capital cities.
Is it purely coincidence, or is it for a reason that they are also close to the shore?
Well, of course, because these were maritime states. Yeah. So trade was very important. And of course, even our very concept of tanah air is land and water. So the sea was actually a connector, whereas land was actually a separator. So coming back again to the question, the closer you are to the center of power, in this case, colonial power, the less opportunities, in a sense, you had for defining what your city will be. So in the case of outright colonies, which were the straight settlements, you basically followed a template which is very similar to England. That's why you had local elections. You have trial by jury, for example, even in the legislative system. In the federated Malay states, the situation was somewhat of a hybrid. So in cases of or issues of religion or rituals, the royal families or the royal households maintain their autonomy. But in terms of urban planning, the British were very singular-minded in not creating towns for pleasure, but creating towns as nodes of economic centres. So what I mean by this is that they would be only establishing towns if there was a mine nearby. So Ipoh, for example, would be a Taiping. Then they would connect these tin mines with the right infrastructure. So the first railway track would be from Port Weld to Taiping, for example, in the Larut Valley, and so on. So the infrastructure, the local governmental mechanisms were made and built for the purposes of the extractive economy.
Knowing all this, right, how would it help urban planners today to improve things in the city?
I think that one key lesson here that works very well even in the colonial period is that if we would want cities to be successful, and when I mean by successful cities, I mean good, great places to live with high livability, a lot of opportunities for chance encounters, you would want to empower people rather than stop them from doing things. Of course, I'm not saying that you let everyone run riot and do whatever they like. There should still be rules and regulations involving waste management, etc. But if you notice, throughout history, eras where cities were more successful, even from the days of the Malacca Sultanate, was when Malacca was a cosmopolitan, open city. Similarly with Georgetown, with Kuala Lumpur, etc. The more open you are, the better it is in terms of the success of the city, in terms of livability, in terms of sociability. And
open meaning being hospitable to immigrant population, for example?
Well, not only that, but open to new ideas, open to innovation, open to citizen participation. So like I told you about in Georgetown, right? From day one, it was only possible for the East India Company to develop Georgetown because of the participation, active participation of local residents who pulled together the capital, who pulled together their energies to develop the town. Similarly here in Kuala Lumpur, without the people like Lok Yew, without people like Tambu Sami Pile, Chan Sao Lin and all these other people, you will not have the city that you have today. So the reality is that if you widen opportunities for participation, then there is more innovation. And with more innovation, then you have got a more vibrant and resilient economy.
They are featured in here, 35 towns in the book. Mm-hmm. Today, do you think our cities are becoming more similar and more homogenous?
Well, I think not only our cities are becoming more homogenous, I think all cities in the world are becoming more homogenous. And this is very ironic because we are now more people living in cities than anywhere else in the world. And the reality is that at the same time, because of globalization and the Internet of All Things, technological advancements, we have become a highly integrated global system. And the danger is that everything is flattened. So you go to any mall now, all over the world, you will probably find similar shops or if not the same brands. And this makes urban living or living in any kind, anywhere, really boring. And so the idea, and you notice that books like Towns of Malaya are popular because they tell the story of heterogeneity. They tell the story of diversity. And I think that is what makes urban living more exciting, more interesting. So in that sense, whilst capital is mobile, talent is mobile, what is not mobile and what will make cities resilient is the unique identity of the cities. And what makes the cities unique are the people, are the citizens.
But people change, right? And mm-hmm. that the essence or the spirit of the identity of the people cannot be constant throughout. And so the resistance that have come against this flattening of the world has been to preserve culture, preserve heritage. And when that goes too far, entire towns can become just populated with souvenir shops and gentrification happens and the people are forced to move out. Is there a middle ground to navigate between these two extremes?
Yes, certainly. You see, one of the major problems in a place like Georgetown, where we started, we as in Think City, and my hometown, very much featured in the book, one of the major problems was that, say, way back in 2008 and 2009, no one wanted to look at the historic downtown, because what had happened was that we had lost our freeport status and we had replaced it with a free trade zone. So we shifted from an economy based on trade to an economy based on manufacturing. However, with the advent of heritage tourism, the city is now considered very sexy and interesting, and you have a lot of people who come doing things which are bespoke. So you have little very interesting cafes, and suddenly you turn around and joystick maker uncle is sort of like the ultimate hipster. But the reality is this: any city that decides not to evolve, not to change, and not to run on its feet and invent new histories is finished. You will become ossified and paralyzed, in a sense. So in the case of Georgetown, what's now happening is that because it's got such an active civil society, there's active resistance to this wave of gentrification that has come in. Don't get me wrong, I think that some gentrification was necessary, because I think a lot of people no longer remember what it was like in 15 years ago, when a lot of properties, more than 17% of all the properties, were derelict and abandoned. And now, of course, they have been revived. But what have they been revived into? That is the key. And if you are going to do a boutique hotel, do one that can be on the Condé Nast list. Don't do one that is average. If you are interested in helping artisans, help them by creating new designs for so that they can get new markets and their products become marketable again. But to say that joystick maker must not make anything else except the same joysticks is fine for the man who is now 80 years old. I don't think he would like to change. But if you talk to him, he would like to make sure that people who learn from him do new kinds of things with joysticks. And I think that is the key.
It's very nostalgic looking at this book. Mm-hmm. And some of the sadness that I feel is that I can never go back to that place, or I would never see my dad's hometown as it was when he was growing up. So while change and innovation is inevitable, do you see this as just the cost of time moving on, development, modernization?
I don't know how old you are, but probably I'm probably between you and your dad. Huh? And I can tell you for a fact, I would definitely not want to go back to those days with the photographs that were featured in the book. I think that you are quite right to have pointed out that these were originally photographs that were used to promote a particular vision of Malaya for investment purposes. And so you have got to consider that some of them are very much like promotional pictures. But the reality is that, for example, in 1860 or 1865, the mortality rate in Kuala Lumpur was 60%. So out of 10 people that were living in Kuala Lumpur, 6 would have died. And the gender equality, especially amongst the migrant population in Malaya in 1957, had just finally reached 50-50. So if it was in your great-grandfather's time and you were here, you would probably never get married, because there were not enough women to go around. So that is not a jolly time. What I'm trying to say is that I personally am not a sentimental person, despite the reputation of having done all these kind of sentimental books. But if you read the text, they are definitely not backward-looking, rose-tinted glasses type narrative. This is actually about towns which were not pretty postcard towns. These were hard-knocking places of entrepreneurship, of grit, of glitter, of course, because some people did become very wealthy. But generally, it's a town of adventure and heartbreak.
I'll end with this then. How should we feel in the course of development as our economy shift or is disrupted, and towns that were once built for mining, for example, or it's based around factories, and these factories empties out and the resident empties out as well, and it becomes into a ghost town. How should we feel about those things, and what can we do to adapt to new realities?
I think that we should take a close hard look at the evolution of these towns. The contributions of the people who built them, they were definitely not nostalgic, sentimental individuals. They were people on the go, on the make, and wanted to make something of their lives. And this is the same grit and tenacity that we have to have as the economic shifts. The reality is that the days of low-cost manufacturing have long gone. We are now moving into a more knowledge-centric economy. It's particularly difficult for Malaysia because we also have a racial dimension to development. Whether we like it or not, there will be lots of people at the back of the train who may fall off the train. And the duty of every citizen, I suppose, is not just to look out for him or herself, but to see how he or she can contribute in making life better in whatever area that you're involved in. And I think more importantly for organizations who are related to government and to governance, you just have got to sort of sit up and pull up your socks and widen opportunities for public participation.
But don't you think your role as a historian is to, like books like this, is to hold a mirror to society and just to maybe take stock for a while, reflect on history, and despite our daily grit and hard work to, you know, make ends meet, you don't think there's a place for sentimentality and nostalgia in our daily lives?
Well, it's not my place to tell people whether to feel nostalgic or not. I can only share with you my own sentiments. And I think that as for the responsibility of a historian, I think we usually have to tell things as they are or as our research dictates. So we cannot, for example, gloss things over. And, well, I tried to gloss things over with beautiful photographs. So I was hoping that a more sensible, rational view of life can emerge. What I'm trying to say is that if you are able to appreciate a book like Towns of Malaya, then well and good, because I think that that means that you have now a new way of looking at life. You have gone beyond mere middle-class aspirations. And that's good for the country.
Dr. Neil Koh, thank you very much for speaking to me today.
Thank you. Very welcome.
You've been listening to Live and Learn, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.